This next speaker, he's the constitutional consultant with the Freedom From Religion Foundation, Madison's Own. They're one of our sponsors this weekend. Please give it up for Andrew Seidel.
Thank you very much. So just a quick show of hands, how many people here are members of the Freedom From Religion Foundation? All right, everybody else, you are missing out. And actually, Amanda's last talk I found really interesting, and FFRF is suing the IRS on a number of those issues. Again, three separate lawsuits right now against the IRS. So come join us. Anyway, the greatest story ever sold, America's Judeo-Christian Heritage. I want to leave some time for questions at the end of this, so we're gonna go a little bit fast. But the important thing here is you guys are a well-educated, well-read bunch of atheists. So you can probably tell everybody why we're not a Christian nation. Okay, you're probably familiar with the Treaty of Tripoli, which was signed in 1797. It was negotiated under Washington, signed by President Adams, and consented to unanimously by the Senate. It says that we're in no sense founded on the Christian religion. You're probably familiar with our godless constitution. It doesn't mention the supernatural in any way, shape, or form. It excludes religion from the government in the First Amendment, and it also prohibits religious tests for public office. So you guys are probably pretty good about being able to refute the Christian nation. But how do you combat the phrase that comes next, which is, well, we're actually founded on Judeo-Christian principles? So this is what always happens. Whenever you get past the Christian nation, they're going to fall back on, well, we're founded on Judeo-Christian principles. John McCain did this in 2008 when he was running for office. He caught a lot of flack for saying that the Constitution founded us as a Christian nation. He fell back on Judeo-Christian principles, and nobody contradicted him. So that's what I hope to give you guys the information to do here today. And we're going to look at it in two parts. First, we'll look at some claimed manifestations of Judeo-Christian principles in our government and in our system of laws. First of all, the faith of the Founding Fathers, the Declaration of Independence, and then our national motto and the Pledge of Allegiance. And then we'll look at Judeo-Christian principles themselves and see how they may have influenced our founding. Spoiler alert, they didn't. So we'll start with the faith of the Founding Fathers. The idea is all the founders were Christians, so they must have founded this nation on Judeo-Christian principles. As many of you can probably successfully argue, most of the founders were probably, or at least some of the brightest lights, were probably not Christian. But the interesting thing about this is that the fight over the faith of the founders goes back to 1800 at the very earliest. Well, possibly a little bit earlier than that, but George Washington died in 1799, and in 1800, this guy, Parson Mason Weems, he is an ordained preacher and a pathological liar, published this book, The Life of George Washington with Curious Anecdotes. This is the book that gives us the myth about not being able to tell a lie after chopping down a cherry tree. This is also the book that gives us the myth of Washington on his knees in prayer at Valley Forge. This wasn't added till the 17th edition of his book, which was some 30 years after the event occurred, and some 15 years after Washington died. And actually, we know that Washington did not kneel when he prayed. There's records show that he used to stand when he would rarely go to church. He would actually stand up for the prayers. So there's no evidence to suggest that this happened whatsoever, but it's a fight over the faith of the Founding Fathers that goes back to the founding, almost. So again, many of you can probably quote Ben Franklin saying he wasn't a Christian. You probably know a lot of great Thomas Jefferson quotes about his lack of Christianity, except for possibly the moral precepts that he found in Jesus' teachings. This claim is actually incredibly rude, because it tends to, if Christians founded this nation, and many of these men weren't Christians, you're basically ignoring the contributions of these men. But more importantly, the faith of the Founding Fathers doesn't matter. Religious beliefs do not claim ownership over every idea that is generated by a person. So for instance, we don't have Jewish blue jeans. They're just blue jeans. We don't have Jewish vaccines. They're just vaccines. And even though the Muslims gave us algebra and the concept of zero, we don't call it Muslim math. So religious ownership of ideas, it is not something that exists. And These men, whatever they thought privately about God, publicly, we know what principle they chose to erect our government on. The separation of church and state. So whatever they thought privately, publicly, this is the principle that they built our nation on. So the fact that they may or may not have been Christians is almost irrelevant. Now, the Declaration of Independence supposedly has some language that evokes the Christian principles upon which our nation was founded. Now, first of all, the Declaration of Independence did not found our nation. I actually got into a little argument with Bill O'Reilly about this a couple months ago. But it didn't. It severed our political connection from Great Britain. Okay? It didn't found us. It's a beautiful document, and I highly recommend that everybody go read it again if you haven't read it recently. But it didn't found our nation. There is some language in there that people say is Judeo-Christian, and these principles supposedly created a Christian nation. The four references are the laws of nature and of nature's God, their creator, the supreme judge of the world, and divine providence. Now notice that not a single one of these references is Christian. Okay? Now, this document was drafted by Thomas Jefferson, then Ben Franklin and John Adams helped him edit it and brought the final product forth. We actually have their rough draft. These were careful men. They chose their words very carefully, and not a single one of those references mentions Jesus or Yahweh or the God of Abraham or quotes from the Bible. All right? These are not necessarily Judeo-Christian principles themselves. But more importantly, this document embodies principles that are directly contrary to Judeo-Christian principles. So the argument they're making is principles, so let's look at the principles of the document and see if they're right. There are two major principles in the Declaration of Independence. The first is that it is a duty, a necessity, and a right of people to throw off a tyrannical government. And the second principle is that power comes from the people. Okay? And if you read the Declaration again, I highly recommend doing it, it makes this point very clearly. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another. Necessary. Such now is the necessity which constrains them to alter their former system of government. We therefore acquiesce to the necessity which denounces our separation. Okay? And as for a right and a duty, this is the heart of the document. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government. So that's a major principle. And the second is that governments are instituted deriving their powers from the consent of the government, of the governed. So power comes from the people. And the Bible directly contradicts these ideas. In Paul's letter to the Romans, he writes that the authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted. Also the book of Daniel, the Most High has sovereignty over the kingdom of mortals and gives it to whom he will. Okay? So the Declaration's two most important ideas, that it's a duty, a right, and a necessity to throw off tyranny, and that power comes from the people, are directly contradicted by Judeo-Christian principles. So they didn't influence this document. And in fact, the authors had to repudiate biblical principles that held sway over humanity for millennia before they could actually write this. Okay? Now, there are a few bits of national verbiage that we have to deal with before we can move on and look at other Judeo-Christian principles here. In God we trust and one nation under God. I'm sure most of you know that these are not actually from the founding era. In God we trust was added to our coins in 1863 and to the paper money in 56. One nation under God was added to the pledge in 54. So these can't be founding principles because they're not from the founding era. But don't end your argument there. Don't just point out that they're wrong about that. Take a look at some of the principles behind these additions, and we can see something about the Judeo-Christians. So we're going to look at the timing of these and the effect of these in terms of their injection into our national vernacular. So historically, times of national crisis have led to curtailed civil rights. And in 1863, when this was added to our money, this is the Civil War. Lincoln has declared martial law. The Battle of Gettysburg was fought this year. Habeas corpus was suspended for the first time in history. The nation is literally tearing itself apart. And at that time, Salmon Chase, the Secretary of the Treasury, he is one of the kind of the founding Christian nationalists, which is a phrase I use to refer to any of these people who are pushing this Christian nation idea. So Salmon Chase wrote to the director of the U.S. Mint, James Pollock, and he told him that the time for the introduction of this or a similar motto, "In God We Trust," is propitious and appropriate because it's an hour of national peril and danger, an hour when man's strength is weakness. So there, he's deliberately taking advantage of this time of national peril and strife when brothers are killing brothers and the nation is tearing itself apart. He's using that time to push his religion onto everybody. Okay? So chew on that for a little while, and we'll jump forward to the 1950s, 1954 and 1956. This was kind of the height of McCarthyism and the Red Scare. You have witch hunts for non-believers and communists, blacklists, loyalty oaths, and arrests. The Soviets got the bomb, and the communists took over China. The Korean War began. McCarthy rose to power, and then he published his book. And then the U.S. built a hydrogen bomb 450 times more powerful than the Nagasaki bomb. The Russians got theirs in 1955, right in the middle of those. And Chief Justice Earl Warren at this time, he actually said that if the Bill of Rights were to be put to a vote, it would lose. And although the reporter wasn't trying to illustrate this, there was a reporter right here in Madison, a Capital Times reporter. He decided to kind of test this idea, although not intentionally. And he took a petition, and he wrote some language from the Declaration of Independence. He put 5 of the first 10 amendments on our Constitution on there, so basically the Bill of Rights. And he went on the street, and he asked people to sign on to this petition. Okay? He asked 112 people. How many people signed it? One person. A lot of people thought he was a communist. He was even reported because people were worried about it. So this is an incredibly fearful time in the country. And it's at that time that you have McCarthy warning that this is the era of Armageddon, the all-out battle between light and darkness foretold in the Bible. And Billy Graham really rose to prominence at this time, too, on the same kind of demagoguery as Senator McCarthy. He was always warning about godless, atheistic communism, and he wrote that communism must die or Christianity must die. So again, we see this time of national peril and strife, and people are using those times to push their religion on everybody. And the second thing to pay attention to is the effect. So religion is a divisive force in this world. This is the reason that the founders chose to separate our government from religion. People cannot agree. When you claim to hold an ultimate truth to something, it's very difficult to find any meeting ground, especially when you hold that ultimate truth without any evidence. So religion is divisive, and these phrases took unifying themes and destroyed them and put in their place divisive themes. So our original national motto, E Pluribus Unum, from many one, from many people one nation, from many states one country. They erased that and put in its place In God We Trust, which is a divisive theme. And the same thing with the Pledge of Allegiance, one nation indivisible. They're literally dividing the indivisible with religion. So the timing and the effect of these phrases, I think, show a little bit more about the principles of Judeo-Christians as opposed to Judeo-Christian principles. These are the end results of unprincipled politicians and religious leaders using the politics of fear to impose their religious beliefs on all Americans. So now let's move on and we'll look at Judeo-Christian principles themselves and see if they've influenced our founding in any way, shape, or form. To answer that, we first have to decide what is a Judeo-Christian principle. And this is actually very difficult to find an answer to. And this is one of the reasons the argument is so hard to fight against, because it's very, very vague. So what does it mean? And I actually found the best answer comes from Harry Truman, who was president when McCarthy started his rise to power. He had a knack for plain speaking. He even used vulgarity from time to time. But I don't think anything is quite as vulgar as what he said here. The fundamental basis of all government is in this Bible. It started with Moses on the mountain. So that's the Ten Commandments. The fundamental basis of our Bill of Rights comes from the teachings we get in Exodus, St. Matthew, Isaiah, and St. Paul. So you get the Ten Commandments and the Bible. That's where you can find your Judeo-Christian principles. Make sense? So we'll take a look at the Ten Commandments first.
All types of The Lord Jehovah has given unto you these 15.
So the Ten Commandments are often thought to be the basis of our laws in this country. You may have seen these displays dotting the country where the Ten Commandments are up on public property. And the FFRF, where I work, is actually suing two schools in Pennsylvania right now because they have Ten Commandments displayed on their public lawn. But the first question you need to ask somebody when they tell you we're founded on the Ten Commandments is, which Ten Commandments? Okay. There, in any given Bible, there are four sets of Ten Commandments. Okay. The first set, Moses gets on the mountain. God gives it to him, you know, after he's talking to the burning bush. Moses takes the sets of commandments, comes down, and he sees his followers worshiping the golden calf that Amanda was talking about. Now, they're breaking a commandment upon which they have not yet been instructed. Okay, so Moses hasn't given them the commandments yet, but his response is to throw them on the ground, smash them. You know, this probably the most priceless relic man has ever had. And he smashes them on the ground, and then he says, "My most loyal followers, round up and kill 3,000 of your friends, brothers, and neighbors." Okay? So he goes on a slaughtering spree. And mark the term neighbors, because we're going to come back to that in a little bit. So that's the first set of Ten Commandments. The second set, God seals with a pact of genocide. He says, I will sweep all the residents from the land in favor of you, Israel. And he also claims the firstborn of all Israel, and he tells you not to boil a kid in its mother's milk, referring to the baby goats. The third set comes in Deuteronomy. It's substantially similar to the first set. And the fourth set is just a list of people who are cursed. About half of those cursings dealing with sexual behavior, because Bible is obsessed with sex. So in any given Bible, there is a disagreement over which are the Ten Commandments. And then you have different translations of different Bibles, King James Version, New Living Translation. Is there any experts in ancient languages or anything by any chance? Does anybody identify this language? So this is Charlton Heston in the movie The Ten Commandments, and that's a made-up language. It doesn't say anything. They wanted something that looked good on camera. So different sets within the Bible, different translations of the Bible, and then the different religions actually number the commandments differently. Okay? Now, these may seem like small differences, but they actually can be pretty big. Don't murder versus don't kill is a translation. And if you can't kill, you can't even kill in self-defense, whereas murder would be slightly different. Don't make idols versus don't make graven images actually split the church in the 8th and 9th centuries. So there's no such thing as a small religious difference. When you combine an unshakable certainty with a claim to hold the ultimate truth without any evidence whatsoever, everything, no matter how small, matters. Okay? And to illustrate that, there's a 19th century Russian sect. They were supposed to translate their Bible so that Jesus was the Redeemer and told you to go out and be fruitful. They translated it, Jesus was the castrator. Go out and castrate yourself. So you can imagine where religious certainty got them. And this also proves Chris's point of last night, which is that evolution is true, because they died out pretty fast. All right, so I'm going to choose the Protestant version of the Ten Commandments. I'm going to choose the first set of Ten Commandments, which actually was never even called the Ten Commandments in the Bible, but it's the one that everybody thinks of because of Charlton Heston. So let's look at the commandments and see how they may have affected our founding. So the first commandment, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me. This violates our founding principles in two ways. First, in our country, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. And what that really means is that you are the supreme law of the land. Because the Constitution is we the people. Okay? So power comes from the people, not from a god. And then second of all, the First Amendment, you can have as many gods as you want before this particular god. Or thankfully, no gods. Okay? So the two principles in the First Commandment, God is supreme, and you have to worship only him, are directly contradicted by our founding principles in the First Amendment and the Constitution. So this contradicts our founding principles. Second, you shall not make, well, and this is important because you have to read the whole commandments. If you go around and look at the displays around this country of Ten Commandments, they're always heavily edited. So it's just, I am the Lord your God is the first one. And the second one is, you shall not make any idols. And they don't ever say the rest of it, but read the rest of it. Because I am a jealous God punishing children for the iniquity of the parents to the third and fourth generation. Your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, your great-great-grandchildren, all of them get punished because of something that you did. This is, first of all, directly opposed to the First Amendment. But more importantly, the idea of punishing innocents for the crimes of their parents is actually specifically refuted in the Constitution. So Article 3, Section 3 says, no attainder of treason shall work a corruption of blood. And what that means is that if you are found guilty of treason, your children will not be punished as well. And that was actually common prior to this. And then it also conflicts with the founding bedrock principle of our system of justice, which is that we punish only the guilty and that they are presumed innocent. Right? So again, this commandment directly conflicts with our founding principles. Third, you shall not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Obviously, this completely conflicts with the freedom of speech. I think everybody can see that pretty clearly, so we'll move on. Fourth, the Sabbath day. Again, read the whole commandment. Okay? Remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. You shall not do any work, neither shall your male or female slave. Okay. So, first, if God is omnipotent, did he really need to rest on the seventh day? Did he really need 6 days to do this? I mean, the Bible celebrates God's jealousy, his homicidal impulses, his genocides, and now we're celebrating his laziness. That's the purpose of the Sabbath. This commandment probably did influence our early laws a little bit. I think we can concede some influence here. We do have Sunday closing laws in this country, but is Sunday actually the Sabbath? There's big disagreement about that between some of the religious sects. And the Supreme Court has said that these Sunday closing laws can't be upheld on religious grounds. So even if this did have some influence, it's pretty minimal in terms of the closing. But it did certainly have an influence in the slavery debate in this country. This is God's most moral law, and in it he sanctions slavery. And this was constantly used before the Civil War and during the Civil War and even after to justify slavery. So it did have an influence, a negative one. Fifth, honor your mother and father. This did not have any influence. I don't think anyone wants to argue. You can talk later if you do. I'm going to group these next ones together. You shall not murder, or thou shalt not kill. You shall not steal, and you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. So first of all, these are not Judeo-Christian principles. These are universal human principles that every society we know of has come up with on their own. And second of all, the Judeo-Christian formulation of these moral principles are not as moral as the universal principle because they don't apply it universally. So stick with me on this one. The original Hebrew of the Ten Commandments does not have punctuation. It does not have paragraph breaks or sentence breaks. It's just one long line. So neighbor, as you see it here, could actually apply to all of the preceding commands. So the way it would actually, the meaning would actually be, don't kill your neighbor, don't steal from your neighbor, don't commit adultery with your neighbor, don't lie to your neighbor, and don't covet your neighbor's property. So it would be similar to reading, don't cross the street, talk to strangers, or go trick-or-treating without your mom. Without your mom applies to each of the preceding commands. Okay? And I submit to you that this makes more sense, and I'll get to that in a second. But first, if it's true, who neighbor is becomes incredibly important. And if you read the Old Testament, neighbor is very clearly your fellow believers. Any of your people, you shall not stand against the blood of your neighbor, your people. Children of thy people, the sons of your people, your countrymen. So neighbor in the biblical context means your co-religionists. It means the people who believe in the same God as you. So if this is true, and I submit that it is because neighbor only applies to your fellow believers, and the commandments only apply to your neighbors. And this makes sense because the Ten Commandments that God gives to the Israelites say, don't kill. Okay? And then if you read the books after that, they go on a killing spree. I mean, they commit genocide after genocide with God's help and at God's command. You're talking hundreds of genocides. Okay? Internally, that does not make sense unless God is saying it's okay to kill other people, just not your fellow believers. Okay? So it's not murder because those people aren't your neighbors. Okay? So this is the only interpretation of these commandments that makes internal coherence in terms of the Bible. And I know getting coherence out of the Bible is difficult, but so these universally moral concepts are disparately applied by Judeo-Christianity. So they've actually made these moral principles less moral. So I think it's very difficult to argue that these were the particular commandments that influenced our founding, because they're not uniquely or originally Judeo-Christian, and they've done a terrible job of applying them. And we're going to back up real quick to look at adultery. We do have to concede influence to Judeo-Christianity in terms of legislating sex in this country. There's been a terrible, terrible weight that we are still trying to get out from under of Judeo-Christian influence on this. Just to take two examples, it was essentially illegal to have interracial marriages and to be gay in this country. And this is the Lovings, and there's a famous Supreme Court case, Loving versus Virginia, and that was the case that overturned laws banning interracial marriage. And some of the justifications for those laws were religious. Almighty God created the races white, black, yellow, Malay, and red, and he placed them on separate continents. The fact that he separated the races shows that he did not intend for the races to mix. So you have a religious justification for this. Same thing for many of the homophobic laws that we had in our country. This is actually the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court writing this. Decisions of individuals relating to homosexual conduct have been subject to state intervention throughout the history of Western civilization. Condemnation of those principles is firmly rooted in Judeo-Christian moral and ethical standards. He's actually right. He shouldn't be using religion to legislate from the bench like that. And this decision was overturned later on in Lawrence versus Texas, so we don't have to worry about that. But we do have to concede that religion has had a terrible influence in terms of legislating sex, and it's one that we're still trying to get out from under. So the tenth commandment. Again, you got to read the whole thing. You shall not covet your neighbor's house, your neighbor's wife, or male or female slave, ox, donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. So again, we see the problem with slavery. We also see the problem with in-group morality only applying to neighbors. We see women treated as chattel. I think this probably had an influence on our laws. And then this is also a thought crime. And this is specifically prohibited by the First Amendment. So you see a lot of negative influence in the slavery and the treating women as chattel, and then actually a direct contradiction with thought crime. And if anybody wants to talk about thought crime versus hate crime, things like that, somebody can ask me a question about that afterwards. So to sum up, the first, second, third, and tenth commandment directly conflict with our Constitution. The fifth one we can ignore. The fourth and the seventh, those were shameful, hateful, and bigoted influence that we're still trying to get away from. And then the few moral commands are not uniquely or even originally Judeo-Christian. And the way they've applied them makes them less moral. So that's the Ten Commandments. I think we can deal with that pretty well. Hopefully you guys can take care of them now when they say that. So let's move on to the Holy Bible. Has anybody read the Bible all the way through? Good for you. I think very few people have, especially believers. It took me 2 years. I had to put it down for about 8 months one time. I got so tired of it. And I have to admit, I skipped many of the begats. So I did this honestly. When I was doing this project, I did this honestly. I went through the Bible and I tried to pull out the most important Judeo-Christian principles that I could find to see if they influenced our founding. And incidentally, these stickers are available at ffrf.org. Obedience is a principle that you will see throughout the Bible. This is one of the most important things that makes sense. Religion is used to control people, so you have to get them to obey. the Bible is just full of commands to obey God. Obey my voice. Obey me. Be obedient. Obedience of Christ. Obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus. And we must obey God rather than men. We could get into a whole argument about that influencing our laws or not. Two of the more well-known stories of the Bible are really about obedience. So when Lot and his family are fleeing Sodom and Gomorrah as the angels are raining down fire and brimstone on it, they're told, whatever you do, don't turn around and look. And Lot's wife turns around and looks, and she's turned into a pillar of salt for disobeying the no-peeking command. Abraham and Isaac, this is the story that is held up as the ultimate obedience to God. The disgusting willingness to kill your own child is held up as obedience to God. So I think it's safe to say that obedience is a Judeo-Christian principle, if not a uniformly religious principle. This, I submit to you, contradicts with our founding principle, which is freedom. Edmund Burke, who was an English statesman at the time of the Revolution, wrote that a love of freedom is the predominating feature of Americans. The fierce spirit of liberty is stronger in the English colonies than in any other people. So the very freedom to believe in a Bronze Age rabbi with a penchant for ridiculous parables and a sickly desire for slaves, this is only afforded to religious believers because our government is founded on freedom, not on obedience. So they're required to believe nonsense by their Bible, but they're free to believe nonsense because of our Constitution. Okay? So again, a fundamental conflict. The Golden Rule. This is often held up as a Judeo-Christian principle that influenced our family. This is Jesus. This is chronological. Here's Jesus, supposedly saying the Golden Rule. Here's the Jewish formulation. We have it as early as Egypt, 2000 BCE. The Greeks had versions of the Golden Rule in 600, 700 BCE. This is not originally Judeo-Christian, and again, it's not uniquely Judeo-Christian. This is another one of those universal human principles that every society we know of has come up with on their own. So to claim it for Judeo-Christianity is arrogant beyond belief. Right? And it may have influenced it, but who's to say it was a Judeo-Christian formulation? Hell. Ah, hell. So hell is not really a Judeo-Christian principle. Jesus invented hell. The Old Testament has a version of an afterlife, a place called Sheol, but there's not the eternal torture and torment that gentle Jesus, meek and mild, gave us, as Hitchens used to say. So hell is described as where the worm dieth not and the fire is not quenched. It's described as a burning wind, a fiery oven, judgment by fire, unquenchable fire, a furnace of fire, and eternal punishment. So you should get the sense that it's hot. you should get the sense that it's forever. It is a very, very simple part of our founding that this contradicts. The Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. And I don't know if you can make out what's going on in this chapter. This is cruel and unusual. And if there was any doubts as to whether or not this was cruel and unusual, the Supreme Court has actually said that being in jail with a 5-pack-a-day smoker is cruel and unusual. So I think being burned alive for all eternity qualifies as well. Moving on to the Christian principle. Vicarious redemption through human sacrifice. Jesus died for your sins. This is the central tenet of Christianity. If Christianity means anything, it is that Jesus died for your sins and that only through him can you find salvation. Imagine a system of laws that was built on this total abrogation of personal responsibility. And think about what it would look like. It would definitely not look like what we have. Our democracy is built on the idea that people are personally responsible for choosing their leaders, and that leaders are responsible to the people. Capitalism, loans, contracts only work because people are personally responsible for their actions. And I mean, our system of justice is certainly founded on the idea of personal responsibility. We punish only the guilty, and we do so only according to their crime. So a system of justice that absolves guilt based on the human sacrifice that occurred 2,000 years ago, is no system of justice at all. There are a few misguided people in this world who think that crimes such as child rape can be forgiven without informing the secular authorities. Their system of justice is crashing down around them. And there's going to be a movement, I mark my words, to arrest that man as soon as he is... So I'm going to conclude with my favorite quote from James Madison, as I do with every talk I give. It is proper to take alarm at the first experiment on our liberties. We hold this prudent jealousy to be the first duty of citizens and one of the noblest characteristics of the late revolution. The free men of America did not wait till usurped power had strengthened itself by exercise and entangled the question in precedence. The Christian nation myth and the idea that we are founded on Judeo-Christian principles has real-world consequences. I fight against this for a living, and I cannot tell you how many other violations of our Constitution are upheld or argued that they should be upheld because of these seemingly small things like In God We Trust or One Nation Under God or a Ten Commandments monument on the Texas Capitol lawn. So the greatest story ever sold is it's not an academic fight. This has real-world consequences, and it's your duty as citizens to speak out against the ideas wherever you encounter them. It's up to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Good job.
Thanks.
All right. Let's take some questions.
We'll do questions, I think. Please. Questions, not comments. If you want to talk to me about something personally afterwards, I'm happy to help. But keep it to questions and keep them short, please.
I would just like you to put up this about the golden rule again, please. I want to take a picture of it.
Sure.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any chance that your PowerPoint is available to those of us who'd like to show bits and pieces?
There's an older version online, and they're going to post this whole talk online. I'm not releasing the PowerPoint. I'm actually writing a book about this, so I'm being a little bit cagey. But you can buy the book when it comes out.
Both sides tend to talk about the founders.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Both sides tend to talk about the founders. And we have to admit that the founders had a broad religious belief and ideas.
Yes.
Shouldn't we, as secularists, tend to refer to the framers, essentially, those who wrote the draft of the Constitution and brought it before the states, and more of a useful reference back to those who did write the Constitution?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. The term Founding Fathers is a loaded term, and it's really a political term. Warren Harding, universally recognized as our worst president, actually gave us the term Founding Fathers. And it's very misleading because it gives people the idea that there was a consensus, and there wasn't. I mean, even when I'm using it, there were certainly founders who argued against some of the things that I've said. There were founders who argued, so really what it means is the majority at the time that happened to succeed. You know, there were pushes for a much stronger First Amendment in terms of the language. There were pushes for a much less strong First Amendment in terms of the language. So it's a dangerous and loaded term altogether, and I don't think you'd be saved by just going to the framers. Unfortunately, it's so in our vernacular that it's really easy shorthand, especially when you're doing a timed talk, to try to just use that. But yeah, it is something that people should be careful about. And if you are educated enough and well-read enough to be able to point out the differences when arguing with somebody about this stuff, which founder believed what, I certainly think you should do that. I think it's effective. So.
Any other questions?
Okay. I'm probably loud enough to forego the
I think
microphone.
It's for the recording.
Yeah. How do we straddle the line between protecting our rights and being seen as just whiners?
Don't worry about what you're seen as. The First Amendment imposes a duty on us. This country is built on the idea that it's built on self-government. And so if you're not willing to get out there and demand to have a secular government, and you're worried about being seen as a whiner, it's going to be really difficult to have that. Hitchens wrote that you should never be a spectator to stupidity, because the grave will supply plenty of time for silence. We have to stand up. If we don't do it, nobody else will. FFRF, we got 2,500 unique complaints last year from people who had state church separation issues. That is, in my guess, probably less than 1% of the total that you're seeing in this country. You, as citizens, have to get out there and fight this fight on your own. Please come to FFRF for help. We will gladly raise a little hell with you. But if it's up to citizens to do this. I mean, if you're not calling your senator or your representative and demanding a secular government and demanding that they not fund the bill, which Amanda mentioned, the Hurricane Sandy recovery bill, which is not passed yet. The Senate still has to pass it. If you're not calling and demanding that, we don't really have a reason to say, well, you shouldn't have done it in the first place. It's up to us. I think there tends to be in our movement a little bit too much willingness to do things online and in groups like this, and less going out and asserting our rights in kind of the public sphere. We really need to work on that a lot more. So don't worry about sounding like a whiner.
A lone display of the Ten Commandments or a holiday nativity scene is easily combated. What is your response to an equal time argument? Oh, we're going to put up a menorah and we're going to allow a Ramadan thing on the other corner, so it's fair.
Well, my response is different than what the state of the law is. You asked me for my response, so I will give that to you. The government is prevented from endorsing a particular religious belief. The separation means separation, and the wall of separation needs to be kept high and impregnable. Those are some Supreme Court quotes. It's whether they're endorsing one religion or many religions, they're still endorsing religion over non-religion, and they are not permitted to do that. So the equal time usually comes up in what's called an open forum. So the way the government gets around it is they say, well, this isn't our display, we're letting anybody display anything that they want. This is what happened in Santa Monica when we took over all those displays, and they said, whoa, never mind, we're just gonna go ahead and shut the whole thing down. That's a public forum issue, and that's a slightly different than the government itself erecting various religious displays. But religion is religion, I don't care which one, they're all wrong. And the government is prohibited from endorsing any one of them. So that's my feelings on it.
Any other questions?
You noted at the very beginning that of course we were familiar with these documents. Where I went to school, no, didn't really go through. I feel very ignorant. So thanks very much. I'll throw out a couple of things that I was curious about. If you have a comment
sure.
on. Women and slaves. Women didn't have an opportunity to own property, vote. Slaves existed. The vote, did it even exist? Was the vote clearly noted? Those three things, I feel as if those are not, those concepts were clarified and came later. And if you could speak to kind of fleshing that out for me.
Sure, and we can talk later at greater length if you like. I would recommend, for those of you interested in the Bible as it affects women, Annie Laurie Gaylord, the co-president of FFRF, wrote a fantastic book, Woe to the Women, for the Bible Tells Me So. The Bible is, I mean, it's got to be the most misogynistic book that there is out there. And those principles certainly translated into our law through Judeo-Christianity. Slavery, I think there can be little doubt. Virtually all the serious justifications for slavery were biblical. Even some of the founders that did own slaves recognized that economically, we have James Madison complaining about how costly it is to own slaves. Same thing with Washington and Jefferson. So the economic argument behind it wasn't solid. Really, it was for most people, the Bible said it's okay, so we're allowed to do it. I'm not sure if that is answering your question, but we can certainly talk more later.
Was on the vote. The concept of a vote for every citizen, was that specified
I can't see how that could come from the Bible. I haven't read anything. I have, unfortunately for this, I have to do a lot of reading of kind of these nonsense blogs that these right-wing Christian organizations put out. Sort of tied to that, I haven't heard anything about the vote coming from the Bible. The one thing that I have heard that I didn't touch on is separation of powers. You may have heard this. Separation of powers supposedly comes from Isaiah 33:22. Isaiah 33:22 says, I think it says, "For the Lord is the lawgiver, the Lord is the judge, and the Lord is the king." So supposedly separation of powers comes from that. But notice, first of all, that there's no separation of powers. That's one united power. And that's tyranny. So that's exactly what they were trying to get away from. And the founders, again, I'm sorry. The founders, we know where they got the idea of separation of powers from. They got it from Montesquieu, from the spirit of the laws. They've specifically said that. If you read the Federalist Papers, Madison mentions that. And Montesquieu doesn't mention the Bible or Isaiah or anything at all. So to say that a Judeo-Christian principle had an influence on our founding, they have two hurdles that they have to get over. First, they have to say that it was a Judeo-Christian principle. So that's why the golden rule doesn't fall into that category. Don't murder, don't kill, don't steal. That doesn't fall into that category because it's not Judeo-Christian. And the second thing they have to do is prove that it influenced our founding. All right, which is, it's almost impossible. There's very, very little, especially in all the writings that we have. I mean, this was a very public process. We know most things that were said and written between the delegates, between the framers, between the founders, and it was very rare that they talked about religion, except in terms of excluding it from the government or protecting people's ability to practice it. So I think it's a very high hurdle for any of these proponents to Christian nationalists to argue against.
One final question. When do you think your book will be coming out?
I have no idea.
No idea.
I have no idea.
Well, let's give a hand for Andrew Seidel. Thank you.